And now we warmly welcome, as we've been looking forward to, Joy's presentation.
Thank you for having me here today. This sounds very loud to me. Is it okay? I was standing back. Oh, it's okay. So this is my husband, Chuck, and he's better at technology than I am. So he's agreed to accompany me. I wanted to say especially happy Mother's Day to all of you who nurture in whatever form that takes. I am so honored to be here today. So many of you at various points in my life have just reached out and supported me through hard times, and I just feel very grateful to be here before you now speaking to you. I especially wanted to mention Dick Dahl. A long time ago, we were in a listening group together called Red Boot. And when I first joined, I spoke a little bit about myself and some of my struggles, which include some past trauma and some mental health struggles. And after I spoke, Dick said, "I wasn't sure I would have anything in common with you." But then after I spoke, he said, "I do have things in common with you." And he listened to me. He listened without judging. And that is basically what my talk today is about. It's listening to each other without judging and how healing that can become. Some of you may know that I grew up with parents who struggled with severe mental illness. They met around the age of 20, got married, had three children, and it's probably no surprise that each of their three children have also struggled with mental illness. For as long as I can remember, I've been very interested in mental illness, how to heal from it, different strategies that one can take. I began making art after we moved to Minnesota, and I'm a photographer, and at first I was printing my original photographs on various textiles, dresses, leggings, that sort of thing. But a few years ago, a friend asked me, "Are you making art that scares you?" I thought about that a lot. It still stays with me. I decided I wanted to create art that scared me, art that has to do with mental illness and mental health. Just before the pandemic, I exhibited a project that I had been working on downtown. I installed it about a month before the pandemic hit Winona and everything began shutting down. It was called Visible, Invisible Landscapes of Mental Illness. Through narratives and portraits, pictures and words, I explored the mental health journeys of various community members who wanted to have their struggles known to others. They wanted to share with other people what it was like to live with mental illness. We all wanted to work together collaboratively to do this project to help to destigmatize mental illness. Then the pandemic hit, and our collective mental health and emotional well-being just plummeted, not only in Winona, but across the entire country and world. What had already been a crisis in the United States was now being referred to as the second pandemic. In college, one of my mentors was a poet named John Haynes, who homesteaded in Alaska for 25 years. One of his theories is that each of us has an inner landscape that corresponds to an exterior physical landscape, and it is only when we are in that physical landscape that we truly feel at home in the world. I took that theory, tweaked it a little bit, and applied it to mental health. I found volunteers who wanted to talk about their journeys with me, who wanted to share with the Winona community how their mental illness impacted them inside. In addition to wanting to destigmatize mental illness, I also wanted to help our community find new ways to talk about these experiences that everyone has. I hoped to help participants turn their pain into a sense of purpose. So I have a slideshow that I wanted to share with you. It's about this project I did. This is a scene, just a brief glimpse of people coming into the space where the exhibit was held and experiencing it. In the background, on the right, you'll see, if you all know these people, April Herndon and Ruth Charles, who were very generous and came into the gallery one evening to talk about ACEs, adverse childhood experiences, and how they impact us for life. This is Annie. Annie was very important to my project. She's one of the most open people I've ever met. She's very creative. She doesn't get frightened at sharing her journey with other people. Annie has BPD, borderline personality disorder. The writing is a little bit small, so I'll go ahead and read it in case you can't see it from where you're sitting. Annie says, "I am constantly at war with my mind every minute of every day. It's debilitating. I was diagnosed with borderline personality disorder 4 years ago. I went through the stages of grieving as I coped with a shift in my identity and struggled with the stigma of BPD. Any stimulus, whether it's the expression on someone's face or the tone of their voice, can make me feel rejected or judged. I have emotional hyperreactivity, and I can feel a lot of distress. My emotions are so intense that they take over everything. It is exhausting. Sometimes I feel like I'm an empty shell with the negative voices echoing in the desolate space. My mind still often wins, but I'm learning that even the slowest and smallest steps are progress. I have learned that self-care is not selfish. What calms me? A strong embrace without words. Being validated for the way I feel. I have a small tribe I can be vulnerable and completely honest with. And I find a sense of peace in prayer and in my faith in God." This is Annie on the porch of a house that was falling down. We went for a drive one afternoon in Wisconsin and saw this house. And as soon as she saw it, she said, "That's how I feel. That's how I feel inside." And so she wanted to sit on the porch to illustrate how her BPD makes her feel. This is an immigrant who wanted to remain anonymous for her own personal safety. She says, "I'm the generation that has to break with my mother and my grandmother. They say, 'Oh, those psychologists make you more crazy.' But I am the one who is breaking away from that, and I'm getting help. If people knew more and understood more about mental health, it would be easier. That is why I wanted to share my story with you. Nobody knew I was struggling. Nobody even noticed. I became a very good actress. Everything going on is just under the skin and no one can see it but me. That's why I got the tattoo on the back of my neck. It's a reminder of everything under my skin that's going on and everything in my mind that I'm fighting. In my culture, we have an expression that means bite, slap, bite. It means sporadic growth. I'm growing bite, slap, bite. I'm learning to embrace myself and say, here I am. As we collaborated on her portrait, we were driving around town and seeing if anything spoke to her. And when she saw this wall, she said, that's where I need my portrait taken. She has her back to us to remain anonymous. And this was in the wake of all of the very hurtful sentiment about building a wall, building walls to separate us. And she had very, very strong feelings about that. This trio of young women, they were all very good friends, and they often went places together, did things together. Bree, who is on the left, these are her words. I describe myself as blative. Lots of kids on Twitter use blative to describe their identities. I'm Black and I'm Native, but my identities don't work in halves. When you turn on a light, you don't just turn it half on. I engage in both my Black identity and my Native identity so that neither can be taken away from me. There aren't many resources out there for people like me. There are so many barriers to getting resources, but we deserve to heal too. There is a lot of trauma in my parents' backgrounds, but families of color don't really talk that much about mental illness. In communities of color, there is so much inherited trauma. I want to put legitimacy to the experience of people like me who feel like we have not been heard. I think we as communities, Blacks and Indigenous peoples, are crumbling in upon ourselves. We need to talk about it, but I think the reason we don't is because it's so hard to face. There just aren't the resources to deal with it. Living with trauma all the time, intergenerational trauma, makes it hard to be really happy. I'm 22 years old, and I feel so old, like I've lived 1,000 lives, and it's just so hard to cope with it all. I'm very tired all the time, and I want to sleep forever. When I was talking with Bree on the left about her portrait, she said, my girls give me strength. Can I have them with me? And I said, of course. And I said, have you thought of where you would like to have your portrait taken? This was taken in a brewery downtown, her choice, and it was her choice for the three of them to stand in front of, what are these gigantic tanks? Are they called tanks? and the reason she chose that space, that place, is because if you look hard, it might be a little too hard for you to see, but to the right, there's a white strip above where it says danger, and the white strip says dirty. So the three of them stood in front of that strip of paper that said dirty, stood in front of the sign that said danger, because this is their experience of living in communities here in Minnesota that are fairly white and being judged, and judged very harshly on just their skin color, just their appearance. This is another photo of Bree. She receives comfort from her cat, who is a rescue cat. The cat had actually been used as target practice by a man, and the cat still has many, many fragments of BB pellets in his body, so close to organs and other things that the vet said, we need to leave these in here. I cannot extract them. She told me, I'm just like this cat. The cat is me. I am this cat. Bree had a very playful side to her. This is a picture of her shoes. She received joy from going out and shopping and buying things like this. I wanted to include this because these are actually some of her techniques of resiliency. This next portrait is by a woman named Delta. Some of you may know her. She was a professor at Winona State before she retired a couple of years ago, just as the pandemic was hitting. Delta says, I spent my whole life telling myself that I was a boy and that I had a charming childhood. It took me a long time to accept that I was actually very oppressed and heavily surveilled as a child to prevent me from being queer me. I always felt like I was performing, and I didn't allow myself to recognize certain things. To pull off being a cisgender heterosexual male, I needed a lot to drink. I accepted that about myself, and I went on with my life. I was a functional alcoholic. Then I began drinking in the mornings before I went to work. With the way I was drinking, my life was effectively over. The support of a couple of colleagues helped me get sober. Before I got sober, I used to think, I'll make it until I retire, and then I can spend the rest of my day drinking as much as I want. Since I got sober, I finally accepted who I am, and I understand that I've been performing my entire life. I finally embraced my authentic self when I transitioned 2 years ago. My transition has helped me find happiness again. One of the most wonderful things about transitioning has been the support I've received. The community has been very supportive, but doctors and therapists don't know what it's like to go through transition. There's so much unknown territory. And the last slide I wanted to share with you is by a woman who also wants to remain anonymous. She says, I look for places where my mind can slow down because there is no away. When you have been traumatized, you live with the events recurring. You fold them into your consciousness. They change you. I've been diagnosed with PTSD. It will always be with me, and I'll need to deal with it over and over. And that's okay. I'm okay. I also have a physical disability that cannot be seen. It's exhausting trying to get people to believe me and having the doctors think it's nothing but anxiety. I minimize my pain, which leads to people doubting that I am in pain. But it's a double-edged sword. Either I'm hiding it so that no one knows it's there, and then when I do talk about it, people are skeptical, or I'm expressing pain, but people don't believe me because I'm expressing too much, or because I don't look sick. So there's no way to be heard. Our culture has all these expressions centered around sight, like, I'll believe it when I see it. But what you never actually see is someone's emotional pain. I try to find other ways to self-soothe. We all need and deserve a way to live out some healing. So my exhibition with these and other very brave folks opened, but it was cut short by the pandemic. This is not something I'm proud of, but I pretty quickly began spiraling downward when the pandemic hit. I felt I was drowning in anxiety and fear. At some point, when I was just really frustrated with how I was responding, I began asking myself, why am I not more resilient? After all, resilience is a skill just like any other skill we learn, and research shows that we are actually able to learn to be more resilient. I decided to investigate strategies of resilience and of hope in a documentary film. Because the pandemic kept so many of us inside, in our spaces, in new ways, I began thinking of space in new ways, and I decided to play with these ideas of space by discussing resilience with people over video calls. So I'd like to show you the trailer for my documentary. I'm going to call on Chuck to help me. Cross your fingers that we can get sound. What was said, if anybody needs that. Okay. So Paul was the first one speaking in the trailer, and in the film, he discusses his grief at having his mother and his five sisters all die, one by one by one, from a very rare genetic disease. I would like to play you a clip where he reads excerpts from Walt Whitman's poem, Crossing Brooklyn Ferry.
To be the new suppose. You that shall cross from shore to shore, near as hence are more to me, more of my meditations than you might suppose. The impalpable sustenance of need for all things at all hours of the day. Simple, compact, well-joined scheme. Myself disintegrated. Everyone disintegrated in part of the scheme. The similitudes of the past and those of the future. The glories strung like beads in the passage over the river. The current rushing so swiftly in the others that are to follow me. The ties between me and them. The certainty of others. The life, love, sight, Others will enter the gates of the ferry and cross from shore to shore. Others will watch the run of the flood tide. Others will see the shipping north and west and the heights to the south and east. Others will see the islands, large and small. 50 years hence, others will see them as they cross, the sun half an hour high. 100 years hence, ever so many 100 years hence, others will see them, will enjoy the sunset, the pouring in of the flood tide, the falling back to the sea in the ebb tide. What is it then between us? What is the count of the scores or hundreds of years between us? Whatever it is, it avails not. Distance avails not. It is not upon you alone the dark patches fall. The dark threw its patches down upon me also, was one with the rest, the days and haps of the rest. Flow on, river, flow with the flood tide and ebb with the ebb tide. We plant you permanently within us. We fathom you not. We love you. We furnish your parts toward eternity. Great or small, you furnish your parts toward the soul.
Working on my documentary film, one thing I've discovered is that there are probably as many strategies of resilience and of hope as there are differences among people. Paul is someone who receives hope, who receives consolation from poetry, from fiction. I wanted to show you one last clip, and that is of Annie. And earlier we saw Annie, and she was struggling very much with her mental illness.
Yeah, I just think like knowing that you're not alone in sharing bits and pieces of your journey. The good, the bad, and the ugly. I mean, there's a lot of pieces of my life that I really am ashamed for, and rightfully so, but I mean, even those pieces, like, they help me really deepen a friendship and take it to the next level because we share the same shame, you know, and there's been other times where I've shared things and I was really questioning if I should share or not, and it's like, those are the moments where I've had people come up and say, like, hey, I'm really glad you said that, like, I have that too, and it's so rewarding, and it makes it okay to, like, yeah, just to normalize the human experience, you know, more than anything. I think that social media has so much of a, it is so negative for mental health, because all you see is highlight reels of everybody, and everybody's filtered and beautiful and sharing only the best of themselves. But yeah, just creating this normalcy about the face of mental illness. I think we thrive in learning different perspectives of people, but also if we're able to just move past that and find it, instead of what makes us different, what makes us similar, I think that's where the key is.
Right.
We really, like, it takes a village to raise children. Like, we're not done growing when we turn 18. Like, it takes a village to raise healthy adults too. Like, we need that community, arguably, maybe even more than our kids, like, so we can support our kids.
I've been so grateful that the people who have volunteered to participate in my project have been amazingly open with me. They've shared various strategies with me. I've been learning from them much more than I thought that I would, even though with that very first project, Visible, Invisible, I once again found myself learning from the participants in the project. Above all, everyone who has participated so far has stressed the importance of community. We need each other, and we don't need each other on social media. We need real interactions. So I don't want to go too long to go over my time, but in the few minutes that we have left, I was thinking that you all might think of your own strategies of resilience and of hope. Are there things that you have found to be helpful? Are there things that you could actually add to your daily practice? And when I... When I signed up, when I was asked to do this project, I made it clear that this is just a work in progress. I'm still very much trying to piece things together. And so in addition to any comments on resilience that you might like to share with each other, if you have any comments for me about what you've seen or any suggestions to make it better, I'm all ears. I'd love to hear them. Thank you.
I'll start and just ask, when will we be able to see the documentary?
So I'm hoping to have it done in time to turn it into the submission period for the Frozen River Film Festival. So if all goes well, knock on wood, I hope that it's accepted. It would make me very happy. But even if it's not, I'll find ways to show it around town. One thing about my very first project, Visible Invisible, that I wasn't entirely happy with is that the very final version had 24 people, 24 different portraits with narratives, and of those 24 people, only 3 were male. And I think it's still, unfortunately, very hard for many men to share what's going on. It's our society is very, very hard. Our culture is hard on both men and women. I did have 2 potential veterans, one younger, one older. The younger one decided that he wasn't ready to share, and the older one, I think, may still share. I'm still in contact with him. He was in Vietnam, and even though that was such a long time ago, and public opinion has shifted and turned, it's still very, very difficult for veterans to share. Yeah, but thank you. If I went about contacting people that route, I might find people who feel more ready to share.